This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're going to talk now about policing. Following the deaths of Eric Garner and Michael Brown, unarmed black men who were killed during confrontations with white police officers, there's been a lot of soul-searching across the nation about policing and race. It's happening in Ferguson, Missouri, New York City, all across the country, including here in Boston. Derek Jackson, a columnist for the Boston Globe, wrote recently, "The deaths of Garner, Brown, and others demonstrate that the broken windows theory of policing doesn't work and should be eliminated." Broken windows is the idea that preventing smaller crimes like vandalism, public drinking, or in the case of Eric Garner, selling loose cigarettes, can help prevent more serious crimes. But Jackson is among the critics who say broken windows doesn't work. And he argues that it's led to the deaths of unarmed blacks by police over petty crime, mistaken identity, toy guns, bungled raids, and a rash of judgments based on stereotypes. And we're going to talk with him about that now. Derek Jackson, welcome to Radio Boston. Really good to have you.
Yeah, thanks, Anthony.
Now, I want to invite listeners in on this conversation, and we're going to hear some pushback from Derek's to Derek's point of view, but we want to hear from you, listeners. What's your view of the broken windows approach to policing? Do you think that explains what went wrong in Ferguson and New York City? Is broken windows broken, or is this about something else, such as a need for better police training? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. You can also see Derek, you can read Derek's Boston Globe piece. You can find a link to that at radioboston.org. So, Derek, lay out your argument for us. Why do you think the broken windows has been so damaging to communities and people of color?
Thanks. Broken windows, you know, made for a good mantra during a time of high crime in the United States 30 years ago or so. But it became eventually became a malevolent policy. And I think what happened is that it went veered very dramatically from dealing with actual, quote, disorders, such as you mentioned, and focusing on those certain acts that were either unappealing to a community or perhaps even slightly dangerous. Or made people feel dangerous, it morphed from dealing with acts to the people who doing the acts. And somewhere along the way, it became black people themselves, and you could argue now, particularly with the immigration debate, Latinos now, black people and brown people themselves ended up becoming the broken windows.
And what causes you to say that, though? I mean, what are you seeing out there that causes you to say that?
Well, two or three things. One is that the policing strategies under broken windows clearly became applied very differently in black communities than they are in the white community. For instance, people use illegal drugs in this country at basically their racial rate. So if white people are 65% of the country, they use 65% of illegal drugs, and black people being 13% of the population, so forth. But the black people and, to a certain lesser degree, Latinos ended up being the ones vastly disproportionately swept off the streets of America for the same crimes as in terms of drugs as many white citizens. So what happened was with the theory, however well-intentioned, ended up being applied dramatically differently in black communities than in white communities.
But this leads to a question that, I have. I mean, is this a problem with the broken windows idea? That is, you know, let's focus on these small, petty, relatively petty and seemingly unimportant things, and that will lead to neighborhoods where the big stuff doesn't happen. But, I mean, is this a question with that theory or the way that theory is applied?
It's a great question. And I think the answer is actually both. I think what happens is you have to have, first of all, we have to step back. One thing that basically doomed broken windows without even saying so is the fact that we've never successfully dealt with our stereotypes of the dangerousness of black people in our society, which has been for literally centuries now. And police departments, there's a handful of police departments around the country that have undergone training to deal with those stereotypes. But as criminologists told me in a piece last summer, very few police departments actually undergo training to debunk themselves of stereotypes of black citizens. And if you have policing in which you've not even dealt with stereotypes of the people you're serving, you're already headed down a road of massive mistakes.
Mm. Well, there it is, listeners. We're going to hear more from Derek, but let us know what you think about this. This raises some really interesting questions about where we go from here, about the wake of Ferguson in New York City, about what's going on right here in Boston. Give us a call at 800-423-8255. And Derek Jackson, thank you for being with us. Stand by. I want to bring in Brenda Bond. She's a professor of public administration at Suffolk University. She's an advocate for the broken windows theory of policing. And Brenda Bond, good to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
So I want to ask you to respond directly to what Derek Jackson said. But first, tell me about the study in which you looked at broken windows. This is a study out of Lowell, Massachusetts, just up the road from us.
So several years ago, I worked with Anthony Braga, who's now at Rutgers and at Harvard, and we worked with the Lowell Police Department to sort of test this idea of not just broken windows, but what is it about what officers are doing in the community that can or possibly will make a difference. So it was a randomized controlled trial, which in the research world is the gold standard. Mm-hmm. It helps you to identify, is there a link between specific activity and specific outcomes? We looked at 34 different hot spot areas, which are high concentrations of crime in the city. That was those hot spot areas were identified through calls for service, which is really important because the calls for service are indicators of what the community is most concerned about. We took those 34 hotspot areas and separated them. We created 7 treatment areas and 7 comparison areas. Those treatment areas, we asked officers to try different things in those areas to eliminate or reduce the kinds of physical and social disorder that we thought were creating fear in the neighborhoods and also possibly leading to crime. In the other areas that didn't receive this sort of policing disorder strategies, those areas received the typical kinds of police strategies and activities that normally would happen in Lowell. After a year of watching and observing officers try out different strategies, what we found is that in those areas, there was a reduction in physical disorder, which are things like graffiti, vandalism, vacant buildings, trash, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things, and social disorder, public drunkenness, street-level drug dealing. We also saw a 20% reduction in crime, reported crime, calls for service in those specific areas when you compare them to the other areas. So what we found is that by attending to the conditions in the specific locations that were of concern, that there was an effect on disorder and crime. But importantly, what we found is that what had the most impact were the practices by police and other agencies, both public agencies and community agencies, that are called situational. So mm-hmm. situational crime strategies, those things that are tailored and specific to those areas. Not so much, the impact was not so much through arrests or other kinds of things. We saw arrests had an impact, but those things that took care of the area were the most influential.
Okay, so this study in Lowell shows that at least it's applied this way in this city, the results were positive. But respond to Derek's point that this concern that what began as the policy that you described may have morphed over the years, maybe even not intentionally, into focusing on individuals in these neighborhoods as opposed to events and conditions.
Previously, you brought up a really good point about this idea of the theory versus the actual application. And I think that's what's really critical here and what we're not talking about. The broken windows theory is not about discriminatory practice. It's not about unconstitutional practices. What it is about is trying to tackle those conditions and those dynamics in different neighborhoods that increase fear, cause people to withdraw and leave their areas and not engage in what is needed in order to sort of address crime and disorder. The implementation is much more complicated because it is up to leadership and supervisors to try to train and coach people in order to implement the different kinds of strategies that are necessary. So I think that there is a misunderstanding that broken windows is about targeting individuals, when in fact broken windows is really about primarily looking at locations, responding to citizen concerns, mm-hmm. fear, looking at data, and then using that information to help to direct resources.
All right. Derek, what do you think about that? I mean, it sounds like hearing both of you talk about this, you're coming from different points of view on the subject. I mean, is this a theory that is just being applied poorly, perhaps?
Actually, what Brenda found in Lowell is probably a very good example of what should have been happening around the country. When you mentioned situational, very specific policing of very specific things going on in the community, that's actually what any good community policing strategy would do. Unfortunately, the evidence is quite abundant that whatever you want to call it, broken windows or whatever the original thing was supposed to be, became something different. And, for instance, the Obama administration has been releasing a almost relentless series of findings against police departments around the country that have a very common thread of a discriminatory stopping of Latinos at traffic stops, stopping discriminatory policing of every people of color, gay citizens, and women under domestic abuse calls in New Orleans. You go from California to Newark, New Jersey, and you find many departments that the Justice Department has found have done at a minimum excessive policing of many kinds. And I do want to point out that in 2004, the National Academy of Sciences looked at the available literature. I don't think this would have included Lowell at the time, Brenda, but the National Academy of Science put together all the available reports at the time and said that, quote, research does not provide strong support for broken windows.
Hmm.
And this gets back to my other point, and I think one of the reasons there have been actual studies, and don't take my word for it, from Harvard and Michigan researchers that did find that the perception of disorder had less to do with the physical surroundings, how decrepit or how not decrepit they were, had less to do with that than the people populating the scene. The blacker the people populating, the more black people populating the scene, the more likely people were to perceive disorder. And so, again, that gets back to that other point that I was trying to make, that we've never dealt with our stereotypes. And so you almost, there could be a lull here. You could have a police department over there that has really doing such a great job of micromanaging its resources and its dealing with perceptions. And I'd be interested to know, Brenda, if Lowell had an active component of dealing with stereotypes of folks and whether that was considered important or not. But
well, let Brenda answer that because actually she sort of had her hand up patiently in the studio for the last couple of minutes, Derek. But go ahead, respond to Eric.
Sure. Well, first of all, Lowell has for many years had a number of different strategies in place around training and relationship building that I think has really made a difference there. It's a very diverse community, and they cannot operate effectively without those kinds of relationships and ongoing interaction in the community. But I just want to make a couple of points that I think, from what I know from the DOJ reports and all of the work they're doing across the country that you mentioned, I have not seen or heard that there's an attribution or there's a correlation between what the DOJ is finding in these communities and broken windows theory. I do think that there is a need for police departments and communities to work on relationship building, try to deal with the kinds of stereotypes that you're talking about, and certainly to try to think differently about how we recruit and train and supervise officers so that they do have those relationships. So there's a sure. huge need for that. I do not know of a DOJ report that says that a lot of what's going on around these issues is attributable to the broken windows theory. The other point I wanted to make is that you're right that in 2004, the National Research Council did report that the evidence was mixed at the time on broken windows. There have been two subsequent studies, at least two to report, that have been more recent, the study that Anthony Braga and I did in Lowell, and then also a study in the Netherlands that have supported this idea that there are, by paying attention to these low-level crime and disorder issues that are causing fear, causing people to withdraw, that there is that the police do have the ability to affect crime. So I think that's a separate issue, though, than mm-hmm. what we're talking about that we're seeing happening. And I do see that there's a lot of work that we need to do there.
Brenda Bond and Derek Jackson, stand by. We've got a lot of listeners who want to get in on this conversation. I want to get to at least a couple of them. Let's go to Karen, who is calling from Chestnut Hill. Karen, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. This is a great conversation with great guests, and it was great to hear both Derek's and Professor Brenda's view. I don't think community policing, I think if you were to yank community policing out of places like Ferguson tomorrow, you'd find what really exists there. Community policing, and I hate to use broken windows because it's not just about, you know, graffiti and stuff like that, as I understand it. Community policing and the quality of it really depends on the values of the people who are carrying it out, and that's the policemen, and I'm glad that relationship building was mentioned because I really think that's a part of it. If you take community policing out of the community, then you have responses that are far more distant, like militaristic, you know, stuff like that, riot gear. If you do community policing, as trivial as it sounds, you have people who are forced to police the streets and, you know, acknowledge that there are people in those, you know, houses or places with broken windows. And that's actually a part of relationship building. It's a place where values can coexist or even be exchanged.
Right. Karen, we take your point. It's a really good one. And Derek, as I listen to Karen, I mean, I hear her. I mean, actually, I hear arguments from both of you in what she's saying. I mean, Derek, it seems like the kind of community policing that Karen's describing there is community policing that involves values, that is training, understanding what it means to focus on stereotypes and all the rest of it.
Yeah, she actually touched on one of the most key findings of that 2004 National Academy of Sciences report that said rather than the broken windows theory, the most likely reasons for the drop, the national drop in violent crime was among them intense policing of specific serious problems and community policing that best promoted, quote, direct involvement of police and citizens, unquote. So she's absolutely right on that.
But Karen, is broken windows a key? I mean, how big a component is broken windows of really good community policing?
Brenda?
Oh, sorry,
yeah.
Brenda.
No, it's okay.
Apologies.
Okay. Yeah.
Karen is our caller. Yeah. Brenda Bond is my guest.
Well, I think it's community policing is sort of an ideal. It's a way of, as Karen said, it's a way of thinking about how an organization views their role. And part and parcel to that is the relationship building. Mm-hmm. And I think that by having officers out in the community, out of their cars, walking around, engaged with people, problem-solving, co-producing public safety in any community, regardless of what their issues are, that is exactly the kind of thing that broken windows requires in order to not just call in inspectional services to deal with the abandoned building and all the problems there, but then to say, well, how do we think about getting this building back onto the market or doing what we need to do? Engaging business and business owners and citizens is exactly the kind of thing that is needed. And broken windows is very much a part of that.
All right. Derek Jackson, our time is winding down, but since you sort of put this debate in motion with your piece in the Globe at the end of the last week, I want to give you the last word before we say goodbye. Give us a final thought on this.
Sure.
I mean, I come away, I'll sort of give you my final thought and then you respond. My final thought is, I mean, I hear you guys disagreeing, but it seems like broken windows would work if there was adequate training no matter what.
I think that's definitely possible. And the problem is groups. It became something that, as I said, drifted. I mean, no one, we all, you know, have a house or you live in an apartment. I wouldn't want a person, a set of people per se, constantly on a particular corner selling loose cigarettes. Hmm. But I don't want that person executed for that.
Yeah. And, well, I don't think anyone disagrees with that.
And so,
and that's not broken windows.
No, but I think just to take one issue while agreeing with a lot of what you're saying, Brenda, is that it's at this whole thing, which started about in the 1980s, became something where you don't have to call it broken windows. And again, it's very important that people consider the fact that it's the people that became the broken windows. And by the time you get to the discriminatory Justice Department reports that found discriminatory policing, you don't have to call it broken windows anymore. It's the broken people.
Mm. All right. Well, Derek Jackson, thank you so much for putting this idea and this debate on the table. That's Derek Jackson. He's a Boston Globe columnist. You can find a link to his Boston Globe piece about broken windows at radioboston.org. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you. And thank you, Brenda.
And Brenda Bond, Suffolk University professor, thank you for coming in and for sharing your expertise and knowledge on this. Very grateful.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, what's the best way to tell a patient they're genetically at risk for a disease like Alzheimer's? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.